Speaker today is Lorraine Harrigan, and she became Dean of Libraries at the University of Kansas, a Division of Information Services, in August of 2006. In July of 2007, she launched a new program, Scholar Services, to build stronger partnerships between librarians, IT professionals, and researchers, with a focus on digital scholarship. She believes that librarians and technology professionals have a unique insight and expertise that will facilitate the production, packaging, and dissemination of data and digital content. The Scholar Services program will help researchers and faculty streamline these efforts. Lorraine obtained her PhD in Library Information Sciences at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where she also earned her master's degree in Library Information Science. In her December 8, 2011 State of the Library address at Kansas State University, she affirmed the viability of scholarly communication and open access at her institution. She consistently supports knowledge as a public good and advances the view that public universities have an obligation to provide open access to that knowledge. For many of her efforts and her scholarship and her work at KU, she was named Woman of Distinction for 2011. And having gotten to know her over the years, I can say that she certainly fits that bill as a woman of distinction. And I think you'll all agree after hearing her speak. And she will be speaking on open access, an evolving alternative, or maturing threat. So with no further ado for me, I would like to welcome Lorraine Harrigan.
When Craig asked me about a year ago, we might be interested in coming, I said yes immediately. Today I'm going to try and talk to you a little bit about how far we've come over the last 10 years in the area of open access. I'm very fortunate in that the University of Kansas is a very active school in this arena. We were fortunate to have a provost, David Schulenberg, in Parliament, who understood what it meant when prices went up and libraries didn't get funding to pay for the inflationary costs. I think we all, as librarians, understand what that means. When you don't get the money to offset the inflation, you buy less and less and less. Even black budget is a lot. And so we lose buying power, we fall further and further and further behind. And I don't know about your school, but my school determines what percentage of the general library of the university budget comes to the library from the state funding. And I need to fundraise in a fair way to make sure that we have private dollars to support the work that we want to do and so on. We rely, probably like you do too, on funding, private funding for collections and or special collections that people want to give to us, like you do, research library. And so, open access is really, in my view, the antidote, you know, for those high prices that we pay for the collections that we need to have for our researchers. Because if we don't, we hear from them, and the administration keeps telling us, you know, manage your budgets better, manage your budgets better. And, you know, librarians are constantly in this complex relationship between the university administration and faculty, trying to please everybody. So, I'm going to try and sit down here, because if I don't, I think the HELO people will probably not hear me too well. Okay. So, although open access offers an alternative to the traditional publishing model that provides unrestricted internet access to peer-reviewed scholarly articles, it has garnered significant discussion and debate. No longer are we at the beginning of the open access movement, and yet we're not at the end either. But we have a decade of experience to assess advancements in the open access ecosystem and the work ahead of us to realize the goal of unrestricted internet access to new scholarship. Before I go any further, can I just get a hand of how many faculty, non-librarian faculty, and the coming. Appreciate it. So the rest are all from within the libraries. Thank you all. No?
No.
Okay.
Students and community.
Students and the community. Well, thank you. Wonderful. That's very good. Despite 10 years of experience with open access, it remains a hotly debated issue among scholars, libraries, and especially publishers, who, of course, probably feel most threatened about this. For libraries, the open access movement had its roots in the serious crisis in the 90s, and also had roots in the scholarly communication reform movement. I will focus on the evolution and the accomplishments of open access during the last decade between 2002 and 2012 using various metrics, including the adoption of OA policies in higher education, the growth of open access journals, open access publishers, open access articles, and open access publishing models and institutional repositories. I'll also share some of the continuing challenges in realizing open access as an alternative model of publishing, and why librarians are uniquely positioned to help realize the goal of unrestricted access to new scholarship. Okay, so here's a brief outline then of what I will do today, and if we have time, I can tell you a little bit more about KU's experience on campus in promoting and advancing this. And I know I'm also talking with a group at 2 o'clock, and I'm not sure who that group is. We'll be more specifically focusing on strategies that we use to make sure that our faculty understand the criticality of open access as an alternative measure of publishing. Okay. So indulge me just for a moment to go all the way back to the 17th century, where the first scientific journal, Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, was launched in 1665, to enable researchers to share their work quickly and widely. No financial rewards were offered. They wrote for impact, not payment. They wrote to advance knowledge and professional status. Visibility and recognition of their work and status matter. And I believe that core principle remains today. I think faculty write about the research and they share that information because they want others to know about it. They view this as an intellectual commodity. Now let's fast forward here to the 20th century, where librarians raised earlier words, especially around the late 80s and early 90s, about the concerns of the current model of scholarly publication. Unable to keep up with the high costs of journals by profit-seeking publishers, librarians remain caught in a very complex relationship between university administrators who expected librarians to manage their budgets better and the demand of faculty for more content, which led to the serious crisis in the early 90s. So the internet became a game changer for us, making it possible for authors to share their work in new ways. Ginsberg launched the Archive for the Physicists in 1991. This is a scientific preprint service that allowed authors to share their ideas before publication. In 1999, Harold Varmus launched a similar archive for the life sciences, eBiomed was called, to provide free and immediate access to all papers and postprints in all areas of biomedicine. eBiomed evolved into what is now known as PubMed Central, that would house full-text journal articles and later became even more important as the institutional repository of the NIH-funded research. The open access movement gained further momentum in the library world when SPOT was launched in 1998 to publish alternative lower-cost journals. The NIH Open Access Policy, PLOS, and BMC, British Biomedical Center, were instrumental in transforming scholarly communication as well. The open access momentum accelerated especially between 2002 and 2003, when three main initiatives, and they all start with a B, so I'll refer to them as the three Bs: the Budapest Open Access Initiative, the Berlin Declaration on Open Access to Knowledge and in the Sciences and Humanities, and the Bethesda Statement to advance the national and the international conversation on the topic of open access. The Budapest Open Access Initiative is 10 years old this year. So the Budapest Initiative is 10 years old. It's 10 years old this year, and perhaps more than the other two, articulate especially two ways that we try to accomplish open access today. The first is the new generation of open access journals, and the second is self-archiving. So let's take a look at exactly what we mean with open access. And I mentioned that these three were really instrumental around the globe to advance open access. And while their definitions and their statements may differ slightly, I encourage you to go and take a look at all three of these statements. There are some essential core initiatives embodied in all three of them. The first is the immediate and free availability of scholarship on the public internet. That's the whole purpose of open access. The second is dissemination of knowledge for the public good. And the third is that there should be no barriers to accessing that information. And it should be free. Let's now take a look at the growth of open access policies in higher education as another measure of how far along we've come in the last 10 years. I think we all know the early adopters were Harvard, MIT, and Stanford's Education School in 2008. 2009, we followed. In fact, we had a policy adopted and voted on twice, making us the only university where we adopted open access policy twice. The first one was in 2009, which was the policy. 2010 was more information about how to implement it. 2010 also named me the dean of the library, or the position of the dean of the library, as the provost designate for open access implementation on the KU campus. I'm not sure if there is another dean, a library dean, who's named in that way. I have a very long title sometimes then because of that, but I enjoy having that title. It really shows the administration support also for open access on our campus. And certainly I report to the provost at giving updates as we go along. Most of you know the roadmap. I've included in my slides, and I believe these slides will be made available, so I have to certainly welcome to the slides then. But the roadmap is a list that provides you with a comprehensive view of all institutions around the world with open access policies. And these include not just institutional mandates, but also sub-institutional mandates. Sub-institutional mandates could be EDTs. Having EDTs in open access, that would be a sub-institutional mandate. Open access, in the way I define it here, is institutional mandates where it's a campus-wide policy led by faculty, typically. So you see the blue columns here. This is directly off the roadmap site. The blue columns here really show the increase and the growth of open access policies and institutions across the world between 2003 all the way up to 2012-13. It is true that among campuses, the libraries take the lead, but not on all campuses. Sometimes the Office of Scholarly Information is not part of the library. In our case, it is. And as I pointed out, not sure how many you have in your scholarly communication unit that. In our unit, we have two FTE and students to work on uploading our faculty's scholarship into what we call paper scholar books, and you have scholar space sometimes. A little bit more than a year ago, now in July 2011, we decided to call on all the other institutions with policies, and there were 22 in the United States, or North America at the time, to see if they might wish to organize so that we might benefit from the collective work that we're doing in this area. 22 of the institutions, and I believe Beth was on that call right from the beginning, when we launched what we now know as COPE, the Coalition of Open Access Policy Institutions, COPE, C-O-A-P-E. I'm glad to report COPE is going well. Strong. In more than 1 year, we've doubled, more than doubled a number of institutions who are now part of COPE, and we continue to have people who want to join COPE because of the good practices that we talk about, but also the advocacy, the collective advocacy, and the power of that collective advocacy of COPE. The goal is to share the good practices of implementation strategies and to be advocates, as I put it. At the bottom of this slide, I listed some of the activities. We started in July. We had our first face-to-face meeting right before the Berlin 9 conference in the Chester Marion last year, and the room was packed. The room was full. People really wanted to know what we could do, etc. So that was the first face-to-face meeting. In December and in early part of January, we as a group responded to the White House's request for information about open access. We developed a COPE listserv. I know Beth is on that list for a while. And in March earlier this year, we met or had our second face-to-face meeting at the Open Access Conference sponsored by SPARC in Kansas City. There's now a steering committee selected to make sure that the groups stay in touch. And most of the conferences are held by telephone. There's a lot of conversation, but also in the sort of lots of communication, and that's exactly where we want it to be. You can find COPE information on the SPARC website. Okay, so let's now turn for a minute to open access at the national level. I talk mostly about the universities here, so the National Institute for Health Sciences adopted an open access policy in 2008, making it mandatory for faculty who publish to also deposit their research work in PubMed Central. FERPA was introduced in 2009, first time. The Berlin 9 conference last year, I think, was a huge driver of people to sign the Berlin Declaration of Open Access to Knowledge in the Science and the Humanities. We know that the Research Works Act was withdrawn in December thanks to resistance and opposition from open access advocates. As I mentioned, the White House's OSTP's office had a call for information. FERPA was reintroduced in February this year. And for those of you following, there was a petition on the We the People site to support FERPA and to let the White House know how strongly people felt about this. Within 2 weeks, 25,000 signatures were necessary for that petition, and within 2 weeks, a SPARC, who really drove this, was able to say we have 25,000 signatures. I think in those numbers and in all of those activities you see, there is a real agenda for transparency here, also at the government level. This year alone, just 2012 alone, has seen several major organizations movement to support open access, not just on a national, but on an international level. And I hope you can see the slide, because the letters are very small here. But the Wellcome Trust, the Harvard Use, and Max Planck collaborated and decided to launch a new e-life science journal. And I believe they've already launched it earlier this month, in October. This is a journal that they will fully fund. This will be a fully open access journal, I think, for the first 3 years. This is an experiment, but they're hoping that people will come to this journal and publish their research there as an example, as a pilot to show that it can be done. These are all companies and all organizations that will collectively fund the article processing cost for the authors who wish to submit. And if you go to the eLife site, you can see, not the eLife site, they've not launched that yet, but the article site, PubMed Central, and I think and the National Library of Medicine's archive as well, already. So that's a huge step, and that happened as early, just a few weeks ago, just last week, in fact. The Finch Report in the UK is another major driver of open access policy in the UK. The research council in the UK, seven of them, accepted the recommendations and adopted a policy, open access policy that will be implemented April 1, 2013. That means that any author who receives federal funding from the research councils will be mandated to make their scholarship available in an open access way. The World Bank. Today, the World Bank is having a webinar about their policy. I missed it this morning, but this is huge because they're making all their information openly available by Creative Commons licensing. Scope 3, your scope school? Okay, so Scope also announced their move towards open access in October, and then finally here, the Global Research Council is another organization that's supporting open access. So, not just in the United States or in North America, but around the world, we see definitely a move towards more transparent agenda. Turn to publishing for a minute. Research publishing already shows the influence of open access. There are now three principal interlocking channels for publishing, disseminating and gaining access to research findings. The subscription-based journals still predominate, published by a wide range of commercial and not-for-profit publishers, including many learned societies. These include the most prestigious and highly ranked journals, others that play a major role in the disciplines they cover, and yet others that have a more niche market. Many publishers provide big deals, and I'm sure you know about the big deals too. Many schools, many libraries are canceling the big deals, under which institutions can subscribe to most, if not all, of their publications on discounted terms. But no single organization can afford licenses for all the peer-reviewed journals currently being published. And people who do not belong to an organization like a university library that can afford large packages of licenses have at best very limited access through this channel. Ask any graduate student who leave your campus and who then have to pay for that same access that they enjoy here. Or any faculty member who go on, perhaps to private business, they don't have that same access. Open access journals is another type of publication. This model turns the subscription-based model on its head. Instead of relying on subscription revenues provided by or on behalf of readers, most of them charge a fee to authors, generally known as an article processing or publishing charge. APCs is what we call it. And that's what the authors are charged before an article is published. Access for readers is then free of charge, immediately on publication and with very few restrictions on use and reuse. The number of journals operating in this way has grown fast in recent years. In the USA, open access journals have grown from 16 in 2002 to 1,260 titles over the last decade. And I'll show you here. You can see the graph. This is also directly off the site. This is the graph also that shows how many of the publishers allow some form of self-archiving. At least 67% of those on the Sherpa site allow some form of archiving. So again, publishers are beginning to move in this area as well. Open access repositories, yours is Scholar Space, ours is ScholarWorks, but this shows you the rapid growth just between 2006 to 2012 of institutional repositories where faculty members can make available their work for access. Now, these repositories do not act as publishers themselves, of course. Rather, they provide access to some version of papers either before they are submitted for publication in a journal or at some point after they've been published, usually subject to an embargo period. Now, there are different embargo periods, some are 6 months, some are 12 months, but that's the green route or the green model that we refer to. Most universities have established repositories but the rates at which published papers have been deposited in them so far have been slow. I'm not sure about your success rate here, but even with policy like ours that's been 3 or 4 years in the making, it's still a slow-going process. In a few areas, such as physics, however, subject-based repositories have become an important element in the daily workflow for researchers. Let's take a look at open access author funds or author processing charges, APCs. Sustaining pure open access publishing or role requires a revenue stream. The business models for open access are varied, including various combinations of community support, sponsorships, institutional support, author publishing charges, hard copy support. Within the set of high-impact open journals, the publishing fee model is predominant. Individual charges for an author can range from $530 to $5,000. Open access policies, decreasing library budgets, and cancellation of big deals give publishers pause and a chance to develop a range of publishing options for authors. And publishers understand that open access is an attractive mechanism to authors to disseminate their scholarship, which explains the growing emergence of the hybrid model that allows publishers to offer open access on an article-by-article basis. But that article-by-article basis is also income for them. Charges range from, in this model, from $100 to $5,000. In 2009, Harvard argued for funding equity and launched an organized effort, the Compact of Open Access Publishing Equity, or COPE, to establish durable mechanisms for underwriting reasonable charges for articles written by its faculty and published in fee-based open access journals for which other institutions do not have to provide funds. The number of institutions in North America has grown dramatically. The predominant model is for libraries to support open access funds, although central institutional support can be found in a few places. The value of these funds being established independent of open access mandates is demonstrated in practice. Today, our campus announced a brand new centrally funded open access fund to help our authors. I negotiated with our provost and with the provost at the Med Center to provide $50,000 over 2 years to our faculty. This is a pilot that we launched today. As soon as we launched it today, I had an email this morning to say, can I also get money for this? It's not a published article, but it's web-based work that is openly accessible. So we looked into that, but the idea was really to help authors who would otherwise walk and pay $5,000. I don't have the money in my budget to pay an author charging fee, do you? We don't. But in many places, the library is saddled with this new expense, if you will, in addition to paying the subscriptions for some of the journals that we continue to subscribe to. So I was very, very pleased and happy that Provost said I'll give $20,000 and a medical school provost to do the same. So it's a one university fund, even though it comes from two various campuses. And we had a small group of librarians from the Med Center, as well as from our main campus, work on criteria as to who the people will be, the selection criteria, how much they'll get, and we'll see how far it goes. We'll assess it, we'll track it. And if by next year we see that all the money is going to go back to the provost and say maybe we should increase it. The idea is to let them continue to fund the center and send the right message. So this morning's announcement came from the provost office, not from my office, to make sure that that message is very clearly from the central administration. I have to say I'm very blessed and very pleased to work with the central administration for that. They understand what this means. So I don't let them forget also. Let's take a look quickly here at the open access scholarly publishers. This is an organization of scholarly publishers who launched in 2008 to support the interest of open access journals and book publishers globally in scientific, technical, and scholarly disciplines. I want to mention Some of the names that's on the slide is a much longer list, but the Association of Physics, what is the I stand for? The
Institute.
Thank you. The American Physical Society, the Biomed Central, Hindawi, Los Sage. These are just a few examples of scholarly publications who belong to OASPA. And then just recently, Daniel just said, Wiley launched an open access journal program to help authors publish in a more open access way also. These do not come without APCs, trust me. Okay? Let's take a look real quick here. I don't have the specific studies, but suffice it to say at this point, Elmo Swan, who is the executive director of SPARC in Europe, SPARC Europe, is a very strong and powerful advocate for open access. And Europe has done quite a number of things. UK especially, I think, is a leader in this area and further ahead than we are here in North America this time. But Elmo Swan reported 31 studies where they found a positive open access citation advantage, meaning that if you are willing to put your material in an open access platform, likelihood is that more people will find it and use it and potentially cite it. 27 out of 31 studies show that correlation and that relationship there. Four that found no open access advantage or found citation disadvantage. But this is pretty powerful to begin to see the research that's going on in this area and to make the case. You know, this is evidence-based data to show that open access works. There's merit in putting it out. If this is what faculty want, to, for others to see their work, open access is a response to that versus keeping it behind paywalls. Okay, so very briefly then, we've seen increased policies. A number of institutions have adopted open access policies, if not entirely for the whole campus, at least departments or smaller parts of the universities. But we do see an increase, we've shown that. We see that major journals have begun to implement a variety of open access features, and I just mentioned Wiley as an example of that, but many others are now beginning to show leniency and more of an effect towards open access. We've seen major organizations endorse open access. We see that APCs are implemented, whether the library pays for them or whether it's paid centrally. Everybody feels the need to help the authors in this way. And that's good because the authors all benefit. FERPA has been reintroduced, as I said. We've received 25,000 signatures to make sure that we show support for FERPA across the country. Open access articles have shown citation advantage. And I think all of this have raised awareness on our campuses among our faculty and our researchers. Doesn't mean that everybody agrees with it. Doesn't mean that everybody is in favor of it. I think when I started out, I talked about the hot debates, both between libraries and scholars, publishers, as well as the faculty. And there's a lot of work to be done, even on our campus. We need a lot of work yet to be done to make sure that we get this message across, and therein lies the role of librarians and libraries. So, is it a maturing threat yet? I don't think so. If we take a look on the next slide at the profit margins of some of the STEM journals, you'll see what I mean. Severe last year, profit margin of 36%, Springer, almost 40%, John Wiley and Sons, 40%, and Informa, 32.4%. Elsevier, this year, the early indicators report showed that in 2011, Elsevier made 37%, even higher. I don't think they could correct it. Do you think they could correct it by this at all? These figures are from a report, the Bernstein report. Claudio Espessi is the researcher there, and the information is also included in Heather Morris's ongoing dissertation to look at STEM journal properties. So, what are some of the scenarios that we can expect moving forward? I think we will continue to see publishers resisting open access. However, they will also continue to experiment with open access models, the Golden Rainbow Initiative. I think open access advocates will persist in their work. I just listened this morning to Lily Crucy, who is the assistant director for the European Commission, and her strong, powerful support for open access in Europe. I've listened to the Minister of Science, I believe, in the UK, and his strong support for open access of scholarly materials in the UK. So around us, this agenda of transparency is continuing. And I think we're beginning to see in this country, with FERPA potentially, new lifeblood into that agenda again. But I also believe that for a long time here, we'll probably see mixed models of publishing. You know, the predominant model of journal subscriptions, the ones that they continue to pay the high prices and profits for, and also the hybrid models of open access publishing, where self-archiving into institutional repositories will live side by side. But we know things are changing all the time, and the only thing that we can be sure of is change. Change is the only constant. Some change is inevitable, and others take a lot of work. So what is it that we're going to do? How are we going to do it? What's FERPA's role in helping and leading this effort for us at the national level? And what will the business models look like? These are continuing debates that exist. And if you go to open access conferences, scholarly communication, seminars, webinars, you'll hear these kinds of conversations all the time. Here are some of the challenges that persist despite the growth and the evolution of the last 10 years. As I mentioned earlier on, while the repositories grow, the deposits remain slow. And therein lies the work of librarians and faculty on campuses. APCs, or the charges, the open access funds, may cause affordability problems. If the libraries are saddled with this, we're not getting any extra money for this. So if you get to that point, push for central funding. Don't settle to use the library's funding. Push for central funding. Faculty do not like fees for open access function, which makes the case for the APCs from a central point. And I know some need to come from the libraries. As I said earlier, many of these funds actually come from the libraries today. And many of these funds are in existence of libraries without an open access policy, which demonstrate the need but also the support from some areas at least, from some faculty. And the final point on this slide is the fact that we will have to commit to strong outreach and education as librarians. I read Maxwell Gladwell's tipping point, and some of the things in this book I like, because I'd like to bring it full circle back to the role of libraries. The tipping point has to do with minor changes that's carefully conceived and adeptly enacted that can provide major consequences for individuals, organizations, and communities. If that major change is open access, full realization of free, immediate, openly accessible scholarship on the internet, then we as librarians can play a role in this. Gladwell identifies the law of the few. I think we all can appreciate this. Isn't it the case always that 20% of the people do most of the work, 80% of the work, or 80% of your time is spent on that one person in the organization who gives you, it's one person, but you spend 80% of your time trying to get through that problem. I think you get the point here. And he describes characteristics of the law of the few as connectors, people who like to bring others together, mavens or information specialists, people who know, and the last one, salespeople, people who can persuade in a very charismatic way with powerful negotiation skills. Do you see yourself in any of these groups? How can we advance open access? Remembering what he says, about maidens and connectors. We connect already with the faculty on our campuses. You have a liaison outreach program where librarians work with faculty already. It's a built-in infrastructure that we have. Open access fits very well with the mission of libraries, and it's a part of the mission of the university. We get content, we buy content for our researchers and our faculty members. So it's work that we already do. This is us weekly to be strong advocates for open access. Open access publishing needs skilled and responsible management. Well, acquisitions, we have digital publishing going on in our libraries. Again, we have the people with the skills and the expertise who can go out and talk the talk with the faculty members on the campus. Be the connectors, be the makers, and the salespeople if necessary to support the ultimate goal of open access. Thank you. That's as much as I want to share with you. And this is the one that I really am keen and eager to listen to your questions that you might have. And I'm happy to share any of the strategies that we use on our campus because the outreach and communication will be so important, but also hard work.
I was wondering about the KU Central Cloud 9 for open access. Do you see a need to have quotas for the different major disciplines? I tend to think of science as being most critical for open access because I'm a science librarian. So KICO might need, you know, some open access funds for any studies.
Okay. Can they hear the question when you ask it in here? So for the audience on the other end, the question is whether there will be specific parts of funding from the Central OA Fund that we just launched today. The intent here was to make it available to all faculty. We deliberately decided not to appropriate by humanities and social science and sciences, but to make sure that all faculty understand everybody has access to that. We expect that the scientists will use the funds, perhaps more because they do tend to publish quicker and so on. But the fund on our medical campus, the $25,000 there, it's probably the fund that they will tap into. But if they need more, they can also tap into the fund that's available to the main campus. Our humanities faculty tend to not think of the open access fund as their fund. We wanted to get that message across and say, the entire University of KU is an open access school, not just the medical center. And so the intent there was to check and track, you know, who may be asking for funds and to make it available. So the criteria will be very loose. It's not going to be very stringent to begin with. We want them to get started and get comfortable using it. So we'll track it and see where the most usage comes from. But, you know, like you, I think we'll probably see it there. There used to be a $10,000 fee available to the faculty of the medical center until 2 years ago when that fund ran out and they couldn't, because of budget cuts on that campus, they couldn't afford it. So this is a resurrection of sorts on that campus and a little more money for them. The librarian there tells me that she used to run out routinely well before the end of the year with $10,000. We'll see what $25,000 will do for them. Greg?
If I can tap into your expertise in the salesman role open access, in a conversation I had with the dean of engineering, as we talked about before, I was part of our conversation was the issue around the reputation of certain publishers and the vetting of content. He was mentioning, as you mentioned in your presentation, about the prestige of certain publications. And so when you're saying, oh, well, we can distribute and make your scholarship available, and they're saying, well, yeah, but it doesn't come with a cachet of the jams, for instance, the Journal of Medicine, and so on. So how do you deal with that? How does that work?
Good question. The question is, how do we deal with faculty who do not subscribe to open access because the stature and the prestige of the journal remains of more importance to them? Probably, that's your question.
Yes.
How do we deal with it? Our policy allows for faculty to opt out. We do not, it's very difficult to monitor compliance. So we can't monitor that, but we do let faculty know that they can opt out. It's part of our policy that they can opt out if they believe that they need to publish in that specific journal for that.
Well, I'm trying to figure out how might we market it, so how do we counter that argument and say, but yeah, it's really to your advantage to be part of this.
Okay. We show them profit margins like this. And we tell them that, all the free work that you provide to get published in there, percentage of that goes into the profit margin. I would refer you to Heather Morrison's study on this, where she tells you, if you pay $5,000 for that article, that processing fee to get published in a particular journal, X percent of that $5,000 goes to the profit margin. I think you need to be real with some of the faculty because I don't believe we have done a very good job as librarians to bring to bear or to bring to their attention the cost of some of the journal subscriptions that we do buy and invest in. So on our campus, for example, our provost signed the Elsevier boycott. Our dean of the college signed the Elsevier boycott. We had probably just under 40 faculty members sign the open access, the Elsevier boycott, and said, we will no longer publish, we will no longer serve on editorial boards, and I forget the third one. There were three conditions that you would sign. You could pick which you wanted to. But we had that, and so I used the provost name. I tell him, and I'm going to use you as my poster boy. I tell them to sign Elsevier. I can't tell you to sign it. But I want you to know this is the position that our provost took, and I, as librarian, don't encourage you to sign up and provide information. Information includes some of this information that I shared with you today to make sure that they understand and get that message.
Do you see a role for university presses in supporting open access?
The question is, do I see a role for university presses in open access, in open access? We don't have a university press on our campus. We have a university press for Kansas, and that serves all the universities in the state of Kansas. It's not a campus press. But around the country, you probably are aware of many universities are now beginning to report to the library deans. Utah is a good example of that. I think Utah State also, and many others also. I think there's potential there to collaborate with them and help them in terms of making that work openly accessible. Certainly it helps the humanities folks to get started in that area. We still accept mostly journal articles in our open access repository. I don't know about you. We have books also, the online books. Some of them were published digitally. And, getting the universities to help them get more visibility for their work, I think is one benefit that the open access institution requires. Yes?
Any article that is submitted must go through some kind of peer review, is that correct?
Correct.
Do you see that the criteria for it? Do you see the peer review process expanding or changing substantially because there will be many more articles, I think, by authors attempting to get published to open access
The question is whether I see the peer review process change because of open access models. I think it depends on which model and which road you go. The GOLD rule advances peer review. Open access journals are peer review journals. Let's just start up there first. But the GOLD rule is very committed to peer review. E-Life, this journal that I just mentioned earlier by the Wellcome Trust and the Max Planck Society, is very well peer reviewed. They have a board of editors who look at that. And so it's of a very, very high quality and standard. The articles that we typically ask for are already peer-reviewed journals, so it's the final version that's submitted to the publisher. So it's gone through all the processes already, and the only difference is that it won't look like a final published version in the journal. So the process is not changing in terms of peer review, because scholars and faculty and researchers in the field will continue to do that work. It's, at least in our IR, we don't have the final version in there, not the published version, but the pre-final, if you will, right before it goes to the publisher. So it's an article that's been assessed and vetted within the community for which it's intended to share. I think a benefit of open access, somebody mentioned earlier community members were here, is that if it's available to community members, they too will have an opportunity to review and have feedback to the article, and some to crowdsourcing. And sometimes that can be a major benefit to faculty and to researchers. I was at the Berlin 9 conference just last year, where one of the presenters talked about an article that was posted in an open access platform, and it was a high school student who read it and countered some of the findings in that research article and wrote about it. And of course, that faculty member or that researcher to change the conclusions that they reached. So the peer review is important. And I think we should not overlook the benefit of peer review and crowdsourcing, if you will, beyond the formal circles.
So each of these open access organizations has their own peer review set.
Well, they would use the peer reviewers that they have in place for their published journals. They just make this open access, the hybrid model, they would make that available to the authors who wish to publish that book. The author's article would already be peer-reviewed, but many of them do now.
So anybody who has not published in a regular journal would have
Thank you so much for coming and for your questions. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you, and I hope as a coping member that you will continue the good work that you are doing in this area on your campus. It's hard work. It's hard work. We are the foot soldiers, and we encourage you as librarians to become the foot soldiers in this march. You know, everything is open. If you look at the web, if you look at the news, everything is open. And as librarians, I think this is a good fit for us. We are the connectors, and we want to make sure that information is never blocked. We want to provide unfettered access always. Thank you again.